This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington, a city where, according to its critics, ideas come to die. But there was a time when politically the nation's capital got things done, an age for big and bold ideas. And for decades, the key to getting things done was one chief political wrangler. He's the subject of a comprehensive new account from the award-winning authors Susan Glasser and Peter Baker. They've spent the past 6 years speaking to hundreds of sources to help them chronicle the life of this man.
I was a Democrat until 1970 when George Bush, my friend and tennis partner, said, in order to take your mind off the grief of losing a wife at 38, you should help me in my campaign for the Senate. And that's when I became a Republican. I was a Democrat. That was 1970, and 5 years later, I find myself running a campaign for an incumbent president of the United States. I mean, it was rather bizarre.
James Baker is the subject of the new book, The Man Who Ran Washington. Peter Baker and Susan Glasser are here to tell us more. Welcome back to 1A.
Hey, thanks
for
having
us. Thank you so much.
So, Peter, for our younger listeners, remind us who James Baker is and why you and Susan chose to single him out for special attention.
Well, that's a great question, and we're so happy to be here and talking about him. First of all, there is no relation, not the same Baker family, but Jim Baker served at the highest echelons of power, basically, from the end of the Watergate era to the end of the Cold War, whether he served four different presidents, Republicans, Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, and both Bushes in very important capacities, help get them elected or help them get stay in office or help them manage the world as Reagan's first chief of staff, as the Treasury Secretary, and as Secretary of State. When the world changed, basically, and the Soviet Union collapsed and Germany was reunified.
Well, Susan, you make it clear in telling the story that the Baker family is about as close as you can get to royalty in Texas. Give us that backstory.
Well, you know, that was the interesting part for us, of course. We're familiar with Baker's dazzling, you know, Washington resume, and that was really the impetus for the book, right? Trying to understand Washington from the end of Watergate to the end of the Cold War. He's a great character. But we were fascinated to see how much the obligations and duties of his family shaped the man. He was the son, grandson, and great-grandson of Texas lawyers who were more than lawyers, who were really builders of the modern city of Houston, at one point creating the largest law firm west of the Mississippi. And Baker was very much the hero son, as his cousin called him, upon whom great expectations were laden. And in fact, politics was a strict no-no in this family. So in a way, politics was a rebellion for Jim Baker rather than the logical consequence of his privilege.
Well, Peter, it's tempting to talk only about the politics, but let's first touch on his family and what James Baker talked about in that earlier clip, the fact that he lost his first wife in his 30s. What impact did that have on him?
Right. Such a searing event for anybody, of course. He had four boys. His wife, Mary Stuart, who he had met on the beach during college, has cancer. And it's really this defining moment in his life because, as he said on the clip you just played, he was 40 years old. He'd been a corporate lawyer all this time. And in this moment of powerful tragedy, the one person he turns to is George H.W. Bush. We have this letter in the book, never before published, that he writes Bush in 1969, telling Bush, his friend, that Mary Stuart, his wife, has a terminal diagnosis. He hadn't told his wife. He hadn't told his mother. He hadn't told his kids. The only person he confides in is George H.W. Bush. And I think that you have to know that to understand the bond that these two men had. And that bond would play such an important role in history in the years to come. Because Baker, as he says in that clip, wasn't really into politics, had begun sort of toying with it before his wife got sick. But really, it was Bush pulling him to his Senate campaign as a way of dealing with his grief that turned his life in a different direction.
I just want to clarify something, Peter. You said he hadn't told his wife about the diagnosis?
Exactly right. Now, this is an era when people, men felt that they didn't have to tell their wives everything. I think his rationale was he wanted her to live her last months without realizing or dwelling on that ending that was still to come. Now, she knew, of course. She understood perfectly what was happening. And she wrote him a letter, which we also have in the book, never before published, that was hidden in the house for him to read after she passed. And in that, she said, of course I knew, basically, that she was dying. And she just, it's a tearful love letter to him of how much he had meant to her. When we talk to him about this, even at age, into his 80s, he's now 90, he still tears up at that letter all these years later.
Well, we have part of it here. It reads, Hands in part. My dear, sweet, loving, and lovable Jimmy, since the night I kissed you on that beach at Bermuda, I have loved you more than anybody could ever love another body. If I have seemed selfish in wanting to be with you constantly, it's only that I've lived for the times when I could be close to you and to touch you. Thank you, my love, for the best life anyone who has ever walked this earth has had. Don't be sad. Rejoice and come to me someday. You know, Susan, there clearly was a tender side to Baker. How does that square with his reputation for being politically ruthless?
You know, look, we've talked a lot about his family already. You know, this very august Houston family and this tragic love story. And I think that it gave him an enormous amount in way of self-confidence. And that is one of the secrets of Baker's success here in Washington. When he came here in midlife, you know, arguably it was sort of the most successful midlife career change, you know, ever in modern Washington, at least. And I think that, you know, he has this ability to engage with people across many different lines. He's, you know, he was at home with Soviets in the Banya, you know, negotiating the end of the Cold War and nuclear arms treaties. He was at home with talking duck hunting with Jesse Helms up on Capitol Hill. And he could also talk opera with Chris Dodd. And I think that, you know, in a way, this coming from this very patrician background, it gave him a kind of a self-confidence that perhaps others don't have coming into Washington.
Peter, Ronald Reagan chose Baker as his chief of staff, even though Baker had run two campaigns against him. Why did he choose him?
You're right. It's rather extraordinary, isn't it? It tells us a lot about Reagan and tells a lot about Baker, because I think that Reagan, while very strongly conservative and a hero to the rising right at that time, also had a real pragmatic streak. And he wanted somebody like Baker who knew how to make the gears of Washington work. And Reagan understood that he didn't. He was coming from California and he needed somebody with that kind of background and skill set. Baker was right there for him. And I think that he came to appreciate Baker's skill. Baker was often blamed by Reagan's, you know, most fervent fans for holding him back. But the truth is, Reagan wanted Baker to help, you know, negotiate with the Democrats to make compromises that were necessary in order to get things done. Reagan would tell Baker all the time, I'd rather get 80% of what I want rather than fly my flag and run over the cliff. And I think that's really telling comment about his relationship to Baker and his relationship to Washington.
Susan, in your conversations with James Baker as he reflects on his career, does he hold out one accomplishment that he's especially proud of above all the others?
Look, Baker was without peer in sort of modern American politics. He ran five presidential campaigns. He was a very effective behind-the-scenes negotiator. But the thing is that he hungered to be a statesman and not just a handler, a principal in Washington terms, you know, with his own seat at the table. And to be Secretary of State at the end of the Cold War, obviously, was a unique privilege for anyone. But to do so at this moment when the hinges of history were turning. And I do think that, you know, that was the crowning accomplishment of his time in public life, especially because, you know, he and Bush were quite successful in working with Gorbachev and the Soviet leadership to bring it to a relatively soft landing. And of course, the German reunification, this was, I think, the pinnacle of Baker's diplomatic achievements. And we're just celebrating 30 years this weekend of the anniversary of German reunification.
You know, Peter, when you think about James Baker's background and his experience, the obvious question is, why didn't he run for the presidency?
That's a good question. He only ran for office one time. It was in Texas in 1978 for the state attorney general. Didn't win. Turns out he's not a natural retail politician. And I think that I think he understood that where he was most comfortable was in these other appointed positions like Secretary of State and Secretary of Treasury. But he did think about it. He thought about running in 1996. I think anybody who's had the experience he had at the top echelons might look at the presidents they serve and think, well, I could do that. I'm as good as this guy, right? And he certainly, I think, would have made a very effective president, but he might not have made a very effective campaigner. But we asked him one time, we had this interview, all these interviews with him, why didn't you run? And he said, well, I was tired after so much time at the top of all these administrations. And his wife, Susan Baker, you know, kind of cuts in and says, oh, honey, she says, the party had begun to move and you were seen as too liberal, which was the case because this was the Gingrich era. And Baker, who was not a liberal, but a conservative, but a pragmatist, was no longer seen as sufficiently conservative for the new rising Republican Party.
Well, we got this post from Laurent on Facebook who says, Baker was ruthless, so he was powerful. Faced with an open choice between morality and power, he regretfully chooses power once again. Go figure. And Susan, how does he reflect on this sort of balance between power and morality?
You know, this was the question, of course, that dogged Baker through his entire time in politics. And that's actually why Peter and I were fascinated to do the book. It's a study in power. It's trying to understand, you know, what drives those who seek to acquire it and to wield it. And Baker wielded it so successfully. That's the source of why people, Democrats as well as Republicans, have admired him. It's really more in the sense of understanding him as the peerless practitioner of the art of wielding power in Washington in a certain era. And, you know, look, he was not, as Peter said, he was not an ideologue. He was someone who believed in getting things done. His personal ideology, he has one.
Pause there for me for one moment, Susan. We're here with Susan Glasser and Peter Baker. Their new book is The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James Baker III. We'll be back with more from them. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Swell. Swell is a place for thoughtful audio conversations that are unlike anything you've experienced. Interact with authors, celebrity chefs, teachers, artists, CEOs, or connect with new people from all over the world. Listen on Swell for fresh ideas and perspectives. And once you're comfortable with the app, start a new conversation by posting a Swell of your own. Swell is free in the App Store and on Google Play. From technologists to podcasters, interesting people are talking on Swell.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
With the unemployment rate at record highs right now, millions of Americans are without health insurance.
This week on Throughline, how our healthcare became tied to our jobs.
And how a temporary solution turned into an everlasting problem.
Listen now to Throughline from NPR, where we go back in time
to understand the present.
I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're here with Peter Baker and Susan Glasser. They're the co-authors of The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James Baker. Susan, before the break, you were sharing your thoughts about how James Baker balanced morality and power.
Well, you know, that's not an easy balance for anyone. And I think that for Baker, and in particular, he has a view that power is something that must be used, first of all, in order to exist, and that you can't exercise power if you're outside the tent, you know, just complaining. And access to power is the prerequisite to acquiring it and wielding it yourself. And he saw that in the Reagan White House when he was uneasily welcomed into the inner circle of the Reagan revolutionaries, ran the White House, a very contentious, very faction-ridden White House that would be familiar to those who've read accounts of our current White House. And, you know, access to the president was the currency of the realm. And he believes that in general about power.
Well, Peter, you alluded to this earlier. Politics has changed a lot since James Baker was pulling out the strings in the nation's capital. He's 90 years old now, still active. You have an event with him later today. But what does he make of his party now and of this political movement?
Well, I think he's troubled by this political moment. We actually started this book in 2013, and even back then, part of the story was about how Washington had become so dysfunctional. Just in the last 24 hours, we saw the collapse of talks to provide COVID-19 relief to businesses and individuals who are having so much trouble. It's been 6 months since they've started trying to put together a new package, and they failed. That would have been unthinkable in Baker's era. Baker was a deal maker. He would have figured out a way, I think, to abridge the divide by now to have gotten something done. It wouldn't have been what everybody wanted. It would have disappointed probably people on his side as well as the other side. But I don't think that he would have been letting 6 months go by without a deal. That would have seemed anathema to him. And even his late life, he's been trying to still cut deals. He cut a deal to the Eisenhower Memorial, just opened in Washington, was opened partly because he cut a deal to broker a big dispute that was happening between the family and the artist. The carbon tax he's pushing for right now on climate change, trying to bridge the divide between Republicans and Democrats on that. So I think that his natural state is to try to find common ground, find deals, and that's so, so different than the current ethos in Washington.
Well, as you said, James Baker served various administrations. Here he is.
It's your job to say no to everybody who wants something from the president. Your job to catch the political javelins that are intended for the president. And a lot of times people ask me what was the most significant thing about your career in Washington, and I oftentimes answer that the most memorable thing, maybe as far as I'm concerned, is I went up there and spent all that time and all those jobs and got out with my dignity and credibility somewhat intact, and that was a major accomplishment.
You know, as he thinks about that coming out with his dignity intact, you know, Susan, how does he talk about the current administration, if he does at all?
Well, first of all, the other line he's famous for is saying that he managed to escape Washington without ever having been indicted. Mm. You know, look, Baker was really agonized for the 5 years that we talked with him through the whole rise of Trump. You know, he has told us that he thinks Trump is nuts, that he's crazy. Those are words that he's used. I remember going to visit him at his office in Houston a few weeks after the president was inaugurated in 2017. And, you know, he was just already the massive turnover in the White House and the sheer sort of incompetence that he saw offended him as someone who's still regarded as the sort of gold standard for a White House chief of staff by people in both parties. And he was also just the political optics of it. He was shocked. He said, you know, Susan, how come he keeps saying that Mexico's going to pay for the wall? Mexico's never going to pay for the wall. He shouldn't say that. He believed in the credibility of the office of the president of the United States. So, you know, again, it was hard to square that with his very, very reluctant decision to vote for Trump in 2016. But, you know, what he has said consistently is, you know, I'm still a Republican, even if my party has left me. That's a position that I think will leave many people unsatisfied. But it helped us to understand our subject. And I think it also helped us to understand how the Republican Party has come to the point where they have accepted what amounts to a hostile takeover of their party by President Trump.
Well, I think we have to talk about Willie Horton. This was an infamous racist attack ad that was also a game changer in the 1988 presidential race.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
We hear that here with a comment from Karen, who says, America is again facing its dirty little secret, its history of systemic racism. Was there any discussion of race in their conversations with Baker? And Susan, James Baker was part of the team that okayed that ad being aired. How does he talk about it today?
Well, it's interesting. For a man who remains very sort of confident late in life about his record, this was one of the few examples when we asked him if he had any regrets. He did cite this Willie Horton ad in 1988 as possibly an example where they had gone too far, although in general he defended the 1988 campaign. The raw politics of it to Baker were clear then and they remain clear now, which was to say George H.W. Bush was losing by 17 points to Michael Dukakis coming out of the conventions. And their conclusion at the Bush campaign was that there was only one way for Bush to win, and that was a scorchingly negative campaign against the Democratic nominee in 1988. And they ran that campaign, and they turned Michael Dukakis, a relatively centrist technocrat from Massachusetts, into an unpatriotic, criminal-loving threat to the country. And That was very successful as a campaign. And it tells you about someone who is willing to wield power even ruthlessly if the end result is to win the presidency. But one footnote to that, the very first thing Baker did after the campaign, when he became Secretary of State, was to sit down with his enemies, the Democrats on Capitol Hill, and Jim Wright, the Speaker, and to negotiate an end to the Contra War, the U.S. funding for the Contra War that had been one of the most divisive issues throughout the 1980s in Washington. And he believed in being ruthless in electoral politics and then finding ways to work with your enemies and your rivals in after the election was over.
But Peter, we can't ignore the fact that that Willie Horton campaign reshaped the way political folks on either side of the aisle were talking about criminal justice.
Yeah, I think you can draw a line from 1988 to some of the politics today and say that that was sort of a forerunner of what some of the electioneering that is more common thing today. Now, the specific ad, just to be clear, the specific ad you played was, I think, aired by an independent, theoretically at least, an independent Republican group supporting Bush, rather than the ad that the Bush campaign itself put up, which was more oblique, didn't actually mention Horton by name. But the campaign did actually focus on Horton in other ways. They, you know, Lee Atwater says, he was going to make Willie Horton into Michael Dukakis' running mate. So there's no question that they had focused on that. To be true, of course, Al Gore was the first one to do it during the primaries. He used that furlough program and the Willie Horton case against Dukakis trying to win the Democratic nomination. So the Bush people weren't the first ones to do it, but they used it more effectively, more ruthlessly, and more successfully, obviously, than Gore did. And I think you can definitely sort of see the shape of politics from that 1988 race as increasingly ruthless, tough, and at times, racially fraught.
Well, we'll have more on James Baker's life and legacy right after this. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Talkspace. Your mental health is priceless, but getting support shouldn't cost a fortune. At a fraction of the cost of in-person therapy, Talkspace connects you to a licensed therapist you can message with 24/7 from the privacy of your mobile device. So you get the support you need at a price you can afford. Get $100 off your first month with promo code 1A at Talkspace.com or when you download the app.
Radio Ambulante is NPR's only Spanish language podcast. Listen for stories you won't hear anywhere else, told by the voices that make Latin America come alive. Each week, we bring you another remarkable story that will surprise and move you. Radio Ambulante, new episodes every Tuesday. Listen and subscribe.
This is 1A, and we're continuing our conversation about Jim Baker's life and influence in American politics. And Peter, you mentioned Al Gore before the break. Let's talk a little bit about Jim Baker's impact on the result of the 2000 election. Susan, what role did Baker play on Bush's behalf?
Well, it's very interesting because this was George W. Bush, the son of his great friend, George H.W. Bush. And actually, there had been some real hard feeling in the Bush family toward Baker after Bush's loss in the 1992 campaign. Barbara Bush in particular had a feeling that Baker had not done everything he could to help win that reelection. Baker was very unhappy at being pulled out of being a statesman, being Secretary of State, to come back and run that campaign. So he was, I think, glad to be welcomed back into the family circle in such a key way. George W. had kept Baker and other advisors of his father at arm's length during the campaign, not wanting to be seen as merely his father's man, but an independent figure. But as soon as the result was too close to call, Baker was called up by George W. Bush and said, "Can you please immediately go to Florida?" And he did. So he really led, the defense of Bush in the Florida recount through that extraordinary episode. And, we talked to Democrats who said, because of his formidable reputation, as soon as we heard that he was going to be in charge, we knew that we were going to lose.
Well, you quote Ron Klain in your book. Klain was Al Gore's chief of staff, and he told you Baker wasn't bothered about American democracy, that, quote, he didn't care a whit about any of those things. He was there to get his guy in the White House. Peter, when you talk to people from the other side of the aisle, I mean, how did they talk about this man?
The Democrats, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Democrats, ironically, when we started the book, I would say Democrats were actually more fond of Baker than a lot of the Republicans because, in fact, they did see him as the kind of Republican that they no longer see in Washington, somebody that they could work with, somebody that they could cut deals with. And they would, you know, hold Baker out actually as kind of the, in a sort of nostalgic way. And Republicans had always had kind of a mixed, you know, feeling about Baker, many of them obviously admiring him greatly and understanding that he was a conservative, small C, but some of them always wondering about his fidelity to the cause and wondering whether he had really helped or hurt Reagan in terms of pushing the policies that Reagan stood for. So, you know, that's changed a little bit over time, I think, because Baker didn't break from Trump. I think that there's some, you know, a number of Democrats today are unhappier about Baker than they would have been otherwise, because I think that, as you put it, you know, that the clash of morality versus power, you know, is sort of at the heart of that that conversation.
Earlier this week, there were reports that you, Peter, had been asked by the Times to be ready to turn in an obituary for President Trump, just in case. But as seasoned writers, how does your writing change when it's about someone who is very much alive to read what you have to say, Susan?
It is a challenge to write a biography of someone who's around. And I have to say that, you know, for Peter and I, it was really, first of all, it was a kind of a welcome exercise to turn our gaze backwards in time at such a contentious moment here in Washington, you know, especially to go back over that period, that remarkable period from 1989 to 1991, when, you know, the world was changing in a positive way for the U.S. and the end of the Cold War. But, you know, Baker was extremely cooperative with us. He opened up his archives. He let us speak with all eight of his children, his former nanny, 106 years old. We spoke with former Presidents Bush's, both of them, President Carter. And so, you know, it was really welcome to have so much cooperation. And this was not an authorized biography, just to be absolutely clear. This was an independent exercise. We were worried that Baker might try to more aggressively, you know, kind of spin us or litigate us. He's a very accomplished, obviously, at the care and feeding of the media. But he really did not push back in any way. He seemed to understand that if you really want to be considered in history, it's not enough to write your own memoirs. You need an independent work of history done about you.
Well, Susan, we got this comment on Facebook from Susie, who says, George H.W. Bush was the last Republican president in my lifetime who seemed to be his own person and able to stand up to the party when necessary. In talking to Jim Baker, what sense did you get about how much of this was about the people around a president, that there had to be people around him who were able to push back?
You know, that is such a good question. And again, I think a lot of the reason Peter and I were in pursuing this is understanding how much individuals do matter. It was in the end of the Cold War. I do think that, you know, Baker's diplomacy and pulling off the negotiating framework for German reunification, that might not have happened in that way. You know, there was a short window of time. Or I think back to the Supreme Court opening in 1981, as we consider this very partisan plan right now to ram through a court nominee before the election. Baker really advised Ronald Reagan, who wanted to appoint the first woman to the Supreme Court. Baker pushed Sandra Day O'Connor. And actually, the Reaganistas were very skeptical of O'Connor. They thought she was too not conservative enough. They were right in hindsight, as it was. Baker physically blocked them from meeting with Ronald Reagan to air their doubts about O'Connor. And of course, her nomination went through, and it was an important part of Reagan's legacy as president. That's an example, right, where who was around the president, who had Reagan's ear, Jim Baker, made a real difference, you know, in the history of the country.
That's Susan Glasser. She's a staff writer with The New Yorker. Also with us, Peter Baker, chief White House correspondent for The New York Times. As husband and wife, they co-wrote the book, The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James A. Baker III. Peter, Susan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This conversation was produced by Katie Klein and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again on Monday. This is 1A.